He hesitated, wishing that he had not already mentioned the widow and the gold.
"Mr. Mannering was just showing me his second issue Smith and Wesson," Gascoigne said conversationally. "That cylinder takes 7 cartridges, apparently."
"Oh," Nielsen said, but he looked suspicious. "What for?" Again, Mannering's explanation stalled in his throat. He did not wish Nielsen to know about the gold hidden beneath Gascoigne's bed, but he did not wish Gascoigne to know about the Crosby Wells debacle, and Arqui, and Arsuk, and opium, and all that was to be discussed at the Crown Hotel that very evening.
"It's a delicate situation," Gascoigne said, putting in for the older man.
He leant towards Nielsen.
"All I can tell you is that Mr. Mannering here has a source of very good information in Miss Anna Wetherill, and the information comes by way of Mr. Edgar Clinch."
"That's enough out of you," said Mannering, finding his tongue at last. "Nielsen, what's your news about Anna? What's your business?"
But Nielsen misunderstood Mannering's intention in pressing him to speak upon this subject in front of Gascoigne. He remembered that Pritchard's letter had mentioned pistols and Anna, and indirectly Edgar Clinch, for Pritchard had said a strange event had taken place in Anna's room at the Gridiron Hotel that very afternoon.
Of course, Nielsen thought suddenly, their delicate situations must be one and the same.
"Look here," he said, holding up his hand, "I believe we're talking about the same thing after all. If Mr. Gascoigne's in on the secret, then we may as well wait until everyone's assembled at the council and share our stories then. Safe telling everything twice. Shall I see you both at the Crown?" Mannering exhaled.
"I am afraid," Gascoigne said presently, "that I am not in on the secret, and I have not been invited to a council at the Crown."
There was a silence. Gascoigne looked at Nielsen, and then at Mannering. Mannering looked at Gascoigne, and then at Nielsen. Nielsen was looking at Mannering. He had a very apologetic expression upon his face.
"Now you've done it," the magnate said.
He uttered an oath, put away his pistol, and then levelled his finger at Gascoigne.
"All right," he said. "There's nothing for it, though I'm damned if your presence is welcome, and I'll be damned if I don't keep you in my sights until the evening's over and beyond. Put your coat on. You're coming along."
Mercury in Sagittarius, in which Walter Moody meditates upon the mystery at hand. We learn what happened on his journey from Dunedin, and a messenger brings unexpected news. There was a silence in the smoking room of the Crown Hotel, a silence that for a moment seemed to still the breath of every man, and still the smoke that rose in coils from the pipes, the cigarettes, the cheroots, and the cigars. It was past midnight. The darkness had rounded the corners of the room, and the cones of light cast by the spirit lamps now seemed robust and warming, where before they had been faint and chill. Strains of Saturday night filtered in from the street, an accordion, distant shouting, an infrequent whoop, hoofbeats. It had stopped raining, though the cloud had not yet cleared, and the gibbous moon showed only as a squarish patch of light in the lowering sky.
"That's it," said Thomas Balfour. "That's it. That's where we'd got to."
Moody blinked and looked around him. Balfour's narrative, disjunctive and chaotic as it was, had indeed accounted for the presence of every man in the room. There by the window was the Maori carver, Te Rau Tafare, who had been Crosby's loyal friend in life, though he had unwittingly betrayed him at the last. There in the farthest corner was Charlie Frost, the banker who had engineered the sale of Wells' house and land, and opposite him the newspaperman Benjamin Löwenthal, who had heard about the death within mere hours of its occurrence. Edgar Clinch, purchaser of Wells' estate, was sitting on the sofa beside the billiard table, smoothing his moustache with his finger and thumb. There by the fire was Dick Mannering, whoremonger, theatre owner, and close associate of Emery Staines. There behind him was Arqui, his enemy. There with a cue in his hand was the commission merchant Harold Nielsen, who had discovered in Crosby Wells' cottage not only an enormous fortune, but a corked phial of laudanum, half empty, which had been purchased at Joseph Pritchard's drug hall. The latter, of course, was sitting nearest Moody. On his other side was Thomas Balfour, lackey to the politician Lauderback, whose shipping crate had lately disappeared. There, in the wing-back armchair next to Balfour, was Aubert Gascoigne, who had paid Anna Wetherill's bail and had uncovered another smaller fortune hoarded in her orange whoring gown. Behind him was Ah Suk, peddler of opium, keeper of the den at Canieri, and former associate of Francis Carver, who had discovered that very afternoon that Crosby Wells had once been rich. And there, finally, leaning against the billiard table with his arms folded across his chest, was the chaplain Cowell Devlin, who had committed the hermit's body to its final resting place upon the terrace at Sea View. It was, in Moody's estimation, a confoundedly peripheral gathering. The 12 men were united only by their association to the events of the 14th of January, upon which night Anna Wetherill had nearly died, Crosby Wells had died, Emery Staines had vanished, Francis Carver had sailed away, and Alistair Lauderback had arrived in town. It struck Moody that none of these people were present. The jail warden, Governor Shepherd, was likewise absent, as was the crafty widow, Lydia Wells. Another thought struck Moody. The night of the 14th of January was the very evening that he himself had first set foot upon New Zealand soil. Disembarking the packet steamer that had conveyed him from Liverpool to Dunedin, he had cast his gaze skyward and had felt for the first time the strangeness of where he was. The skies were inverted, the patterns unfamiliar, the pole star beneath his feet quite swallowed. At first he searched for it stupidly, wanting to measure his present latitude from the incline of his rigid arm, as he had done as a boy on the other side of the earth. He found Orion, upended, his quiver beneath him, his sword hanging upward from his belt. Carnis Major hanging like a dead dog from a butcher's hook. There was something very sad about it, Moody thought. It was as if the ancient patterns had no meaning here. At length he found the southern crux, and tried to recall the rule for locating the pole, for there was no equivalent star to mark it here in the black of the Antipodes, where everything was upended and unformed. Did one use the crossbar of the thing? Or the spar? He could not remember. There was some kind of formula, the length of a knuckle, some equation, a matter of inches. It had bothered him extremely that there